Now here's your host, Michael Corbin.
Now, in November of 1975, there was a very interesting incident that happened in the Sitgreaves National Forest in Arizona. It happened to seven men who were returning from a tree cutting contract that they were working in the remote areas of the Mogollon Rim, I believe is the right pronunciation of the area. And coming back, and I'm going to let them tell the story, but I'm just giving you the highlights here. Travis Walton jumped out of the truck and was looking at this object and was zapped by a beam of energy. And this launched a five-day intensive manhunt that turned up nothing until Travis was returned. This experience has been probably one of the most corroborated experiences of alien interaction or something that occurred in that time frame. And over the years, Travis has received a lot of flack, if you will, from one of our friends out there in the UFO community, an arch debunker, I call him. But there's been a lot of stuff and controversy surrounding this. And in 1993, a movie was produced called Fire in the Sky, and it detailed this experience. And now there is a book on the market called Fire in the Sky, the Walton Experience, that has been written by Travis Walton. And basically, this book, essentially, is what I've been told, sets the record straight. So it's my pleasure to welcome to the program tonight Mike Rogers and Travis Walton. Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening. How are you doing, Michael?
Good. Thanks for being on the program. For our listeners that are not familiar with your case, let's take the first segment and recount the experience, and then we'll talk about the book, okay?
Yeah, well, why don't you go ahead, Mike?
Okay. Where do you want me to start?
Just tell us what happened out there in November of 1975.
Well, for those who don't already know, the story's been told many times, and the movie covered it pretty well. That's the part of the movie that was more along the lines of reality than some of the other. But in 1975, I had a contract with the Forest Service to thin trees, and on this particular day, we were piling brush. We had to create a fire line that, in case of future fires, that where the material that we cut was also stacked up in piles, and they would later burn it, you know, and get rid of the material that way. We were working towards the top of the rim, and we might have been a quarter of a mile, half a mile from the top of the rim when the day ended that day. In fact, we worked until after sunset, almost until dark, and there was six guys working for me. Travis was one of those. And we piled in the truck and headed up the road. And as we got up a little closer towards the rim road, these guys started noticing something coming through the trees from the right side of the truck. And it looked unusual looking light. They started wondering what it could be because it was so strange. And as we went up around a corner, and of course, me driving and being a bad road and also kind of steep off the left side there, I couldn't really take my eyes off the road except for just very brief glances. But as we rounded kind of a little bit of a curve and came into an opening where the dense thicket let way to a small opening to our right, whatever this was straight to the right side of the truck, towards the west. And somebody yelled out to stop the truck, so I did. And at this particular point, this thing being to my right and quite a bit above the cab of the truck, I couldn't see it at all. And I didn't know that these other guys were seeing something that was alarming them. I went ahead and turned the truck off. Just as I turned the truck off and looked to my right, Travis, who was sitting in the right front seat of a crew cab truck, he was already out of the truck and walking up towards this thing. And I looked at the guys, and their eyes are big, and they're looking at me, but I can't see it. So I lean over, down, and whoa, there it is. About 20 feet off the ground, there's this large glowing object. It's not extremely bright, just a very odd light that was lighting up the whole area there. And Travis was continuing on his short trek up to this thing. This thing wasn't more than about 100 feet from the truck, which we later confirmed to be quite accurate distance. It was sort of down in this clearing. There was a few small trees in the clearing, very small ones, and the clearing was in the larger trees, saw timber-sized trees. This thing was down in there. But not on the ground. And so when Travis got up to where he was more or less under the thing, you know, he was just standing there looking up, and he stopped right there by a brush pile, a slash pile that had been piled up by the bulldozers in the logging operation. And he looked back at us. At this point, we started yelling at him because what we were seeing was kind of frightening. It was beautiful, but at the same time, it was very frightening.
Sure.
And I yelled at Travis to get back. Nobody else got out of the truck. He's the only one that did. But he stood there, and while he was standing there, this thing started moving, and it started making a sound. It was low at first, and then it gained in volume. And a strange sound, like everybody you've ever had try to explain the sounds these things make. You can't explain it, certainly not with a human voice. Just a very strange, multi-tonal sound, high-pitched sounds, very low sounds. In fact, some sound there was so low it was started vibrating the truck and the ground, and you could feel it. I could feel it through the steering wheel. And when this object started making this louder volume of sound, it started moving and it rose up a little bit. It sort of started wobbling a little bit, just very gently, just a real gentle, slow wobble, kind of an oscillating motion. But the front of it, or the part that was towards us, never changed. It didn't spin or anything. It just sort of wobbled slowly. And this frightened Travis, you could tell, because he ducked down by a log that was sticking out of the slash pile he was standing by. And he was there for a couple of seconds. We're yelling at him, get the hell out of there, you know. Get back to the truck. And he apparently got the message. He stood up and started to turn, like all in one motion. And just as he did, something came out of the bottom of this thing, a bolt of energy of some kind, very bright, brilliant flash that blinded me temporarily. And I had actually myself turned away from there right at that, just before this beam struck. I had turned my gaze away to restart the truck because by this time I could see that having the truck running was a much better thing to be doing. And I turned the truck on, or was starting to turn the truck on, and this brilliant flash of bluish green light just lit up the entire woods brighter than daylight and inside the truck. And I turned back around and looked back that direction, and Travis was just flying backwards through the air, just limp and motionless. And he hit the ground just flat on his back, and he just kind of bounced a little bit, and it was real dry in the woods right at that time, and there was, you know, the ground was dusty, and I saw the dust rolling up around him there. And, you know, this was so frightening that it was a simultaneous thing. At least one, maybe two of the guys were yelling from the back of the truck to get the hell out of there at the same time I was hitting the gas.
Everybody just basically flew into hysterics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I took off down the road and didn't stop for a quarter of a mile after I could see that it wasn't chasing us.
Okay. Mike, Travis, hold on. We're going to go to another break. When we come back, we'll get into the book and we're going to set the record straight tonight with some of the stuff, and the book is, of course, going to do that as well. Once again, joining me from Arizona is Mike Rogers and Travis Walton. We're talking about the new book, Fire in the Sky, The Walton Experience. And, guys, what is the one thing about this publication of this book that you want to set straight? What's the main thing?
Well, basically there's two things, you know, the differences between the movie and the real story. You know, now that so many people are familiar with the fact that this happened, many people have a sort of a misconception of what actually happened because of the artistic license that was exercised in the movie. And then on the other hand, there's some other new revelations that we make concerning the efforts to discredit the incident.
Okay. Now, on the part of the movie, Tracy Torme was the screenwriter for that, and of course the producer. And the one thing that I know from knowing Tracy, and I know you guys know him pretty well too, the movie did seem to unsettle some people about the experience. What can you tell us about where the actions are, where the thing differed from the movie and from what actually happened?
Well, I think Tracy Torme did his best to
right.
Protect the integrity of his work. But, you know, once the screenplay is sold to the studio, there's a variety of different influences and, you know, pretty powerful factors come into play that are, you know, kind of like out of the hands of the scriptwriter and certainly out of the person originally giving up their rights.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I wasn't really privy to all that went on there as to why these things went on, but these changes were made. But nevertheless, they were, and over my objections in most cases. You know, there were some departures from what happened that, you know, I can understand in terms of just, you know, translating something that spans so much time into, you know, a 90 minutes of screen time. You know, there's a certain amount of simplification that's necessary.
Give us an example of one of those departures. I know the one thing was the actual onboard scene. I know that you can only recall, what, approximately 2 hours out of that 5 days.
Yeah. Yeah, just a very brief period of time. I was pretty hysterical the whole time. But you know, other than in a symbolic fashion, the events that were depicted in the movie don't really correlate at all with what actually happened.
I know that one of the reasons that Tracy told me was that it was difficult to recreate on screen the emotions and the circumstance that you were feeling, not only with the environment, but just in, you know, emotionally, internally.
Yeah, you know, it's so much of what was going on inside of my head, you know. And other than having sort of a thing where you can have a voice talking about what's going on in somebody's mind,
right.
It's kind of hard to show the level of intense feeling and emotion and the thoughts that were going on in my head.
Uh-huh. So as far as the book is concerned, Travis, what are you doing as far as how do you describe or how do you repair or go back and point out these detractions that the movie took?
Well, you know, for the person that has seen the movie, then simply reading the account of how it actually occurred, you know, should be enough, and they can draw their own conclusions. Although I do go into, you know, some points, you know, and drawing parallels and things, you know. For instance, you know, when I regained consciousness, I was in a tremendous amount of pain, and I was having trouble breathing. I was, you know, felt this suffocating feeling that just added to my panic.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, this would be very difficult to portray on the screen.
Sure.
You know, you'd have somebody standing there breathing hard, looking scared, but you wouldn't really understand the pain unless you show someone being hurt. So they took the step of you know, showing these things that being inflicted upon the actor. That didn't actually occur, in order to, you know, I surmise, demonstrate pain. There's a scene where the actor is struggling to move, struggling to breathe with this membrane covering his body, which didn't happen, but it does very accurately bring forth in the audience this feeling of panic that one gets when one's suffocating. And that's sort of the feeling that I had, you know, one of the...
Right.
Things that were going on.
And I have to agree with you. I think that in lieu of the difficult situation, what we were dealing with here, that Tracy did the best that he could as far as portraying that. Now, let's move on to the controversy surrounding the incident, because I know that there is a considerable amount of time dedicated in the book to this flack that you got. And I myself personally feel that it was unwarranted. Because, again, you know, all of the gentlemen that were involved in this passed lie detector tests. And, of course, this is the first time we've ever had such a spectacular incident that had corroborating witnesses. And, of course, you being gone for the 5 days.
Yes, but, you know, for many reasons, people from many different quarters were just desperate to explain this away, not just the skeptics. People were latching on to any little explanation that came along any way they could. You know, right off the bat, well, they murdered him and made up the story to cover up for that. And then when I was returned, well, you know, it was a drug hallucination or whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so one by one, I've got to go through and very tediously and meticulously document each thing that refutes these sorts of claims. You know, for instance, the fact that my blood and urine samples were put through the Maricopa County Medical Examiner's drug screen. No trace of any drug whatsoever.
Now, speaking of that, Travis, if I may, what did the blood, the urine and the blood sample, did they show anything that would substantiate the claim that you were gone 5 days?
No, there wasn't anything. I mean, what would there be?
I can't imagine.
An unknown substance,
right,
or something like
but
that.
But it did show that you were not under the influence of any narcotics.
Of course, it doesn't really preclude that there was an unknown substance in there, since they wouldn't have been looking for anything like that. They wouldn't have known what to look for.
Right, right. Mike, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
What for you was the most difficult part of this? Because I know in our next segment we'll talk about some of the stuff that happened, but I know that there was an intense manhunt launched when you guys went back to town without Travis and contacted the sheriff. What was the most difficult part of this for you and your family?
Well, there were two things that were real hard for me to deal with. One was right away, and that was the suspicions of murder, which turned into accusations of murder, which ended up in us all taking a lie detector test, which we all passed, both to the truth of the UFO incident, the UFO, and, of course, to not having harmed Travis or murdered him or anything like that. But there were several days there before the lie detector tests were conducted during the search. The search was lasted 4 days. And during that search, especially within the last couple of days, it got very heavy. In fact, there were some outbreaks there. One of Travis's brothers was believing of us because he knew me personally, and the other was very hostile. I mean, he was just hot mad.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a number of things that happened there, and the finger got pointed, and it got very heavy and very disturbing and very hard to handle. Of course, that was all just blown completely out of the way when we took our lie detector tests and passed them. And then, of course, Travis, within a day or so after the results of the lie detector tests were given out, was returned. So between those, that pretty well set that aside. The second thing that happened not too long after the incident, I was at a family reunion, and it was the Howard family reunion on the other side of my family. And we were enjoying ourselves, and here comes a guy, burly-looking guy, kind of a stern face, and he flashes back, says that he's a federal criminal investigator, and he's here because I have been charged with various charges, which turned out to be trumped-up charges, but he made an entrance there and got me embarrassed and whatnot, and that was just the beginning. He spent more than a month investigating every aspect of my life. I had to go through my income taxes way back, all my contract records, blah, blah, blah. And he was very serious and very stern. He voiced his opinion on more than one occasion.
This was after Travis had come back, too, right?
This was actually quite a long time.
So apparently it seems like, you know, even after this, there's been some harassment even, maybe, possibly.
I would consider that harassment, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Returning from Arizona is my guest tonight, Travis Walton and Mike Rogers. We're talking about the Walton experience as it's become known, and their newest book, Fire in the Sky, and it's essentially going to set the record straight. We're talking a little bit about that tonight, and welcome back, guys.
Hey.
What would you say, one of the things we hear about in a lot of abduction experiences, and I know that this one, we're very careful not to say that this was a typical abduction experience. Do you feel that it was an accident? That this is that your best theory?
Well, you know, I speculate in the book about various scenarios that would fit the facts as I understand them. But, you know, I do have to say that whatever conclusion I draw is just speculation. But I do lean more towards the idea that it was just an accident, that somehow my spontaneous foolishness, you know, to get too close to this thing is what brought it all about.
What do you ever have any fear, Travis, of a repeat? Some people say that the one thing that worries them about it is having it happen again. Has it ever happened again? Have you ever had any unusual experiences since then?
Well, I got to say that for a long time I was very scared, you know, about that.
Uh-huh.
But as time went on, I, you know, managed to convince myself that this was a singularity and wasn't gonna.
So it was just one of those isolated incidents.
Yeah.
Wrong place, wrong time. But Back to the one thing that really fascinates me about the case is the human element that's involved here, and you know, all of the things that took place. Again, you know, you have a case where you have a lot of corroborative eyewitness testimony. First eyewitness people that were there saw what happened. And despite that, and even the fact that, you know, all of these things occurred, people still are in the mode of disbelief. Why do you think that is?
Well, I don't know. You know, I think that as the facts have trickled through over time, that acceptance of this case has grown. And in a way, I think the extreme variety of charges that were brought by the skeptics and my ability to show all of those as being without substance, in a way, makes their charges just that much more corroboration.
Mm-hmm. What, Travis or Mike, one of the two of you can answer this. What one element of the controversy was the most prominent? What was it? The Phil Klass attacks?
Yeah, answer that, Travis.
Say that again.
I'm just curious, which element of this whole controversy was the one that was the most prominent? Was it the Phil Klass?
Oh yeah, that was, and it was a great source of pain for me because these attacks got way off of the relevant facts of the matter and just degenerated into a lot of personal character attacks and. Against me and, you know, people like my mother of all people, you know, just that, it, you know, it was really pretty hurtful.
See, one of the things I noticed that we wrestle with in the research community is these attacks that come from that camp, that PSYCOP, CSICOP group. And, you know, I myself am a skeptical believer, and I think that is, when you say skeptic, you think of somebody who is open-minded to a reality or to something that's extraordinary, but is not absolutely totally committed, you know, in lack of substantial evidence to indicate that there are extraterrestrials. But the one thing that we can always count on is that this is more of a debunking, which is just a dismissal out of hand, where regardless of what evidence there is. And I think that this is one of the things that we've seen with your case, because we know that there's been a lot of negative publicity. There's been a lot of negative attacks on you. Shore up for us in a short time. What are the things what are the elements? So, for example, I understand that there was some electrical interference in the area. Is that true?
Yes. The APRO took these reports. They were offered or volunteered from people who lived in the area and sent in, you know, information about television reception and power outages, and that's was drawn from their files.
Okay.
And also, we were able to obtain a portion of the police file on the case, and this was deer hunting season when this happened, and there were a number of deer hunters who were witnesses to this phenomenon at the time or right in those days.
Okay, Travis, one quick question I have before we go to our next break. I know that you're not much of a conspiracy buff or somebody who's into the conspiratorial thing, but
right.
I think in some ways you are seeing things that have happened since then that maybe change your mind.
Yes, there's definitely been some disturbing events that, you know, I was reluctantly forced to reconsider those kinds of concepts.
Do you think that there is a government cover-up? Do you think that there is some knowledge that is being withheld from the public about this phenomenon?
I definitely think they know more than they're letting on, and in relation to this case, I think that there's some evidence here that I have documented in the book that...
Okay.
Points that way, for sure.
All right. We have a very short time left. One of you gentlemen, I don't care who it is that wants to pick this up, tell us real quick in about 30, 45 seconds, how has this experience changed your life?
Boy, that's a big one. You know, you come to a fork in the road in your life and something happens to you that just profoundly changes everything. You know that everything from that point on is going to be vastly different than it would have been. But since you don't know how things would have been had it not happened, it's really hard to pinpoint things. But I tell you, it has really been an education. I've learned a lot about people and so-called experts.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I would imagine, I have to agree with you, too. I think that this would teach me more about human behavior than it would about alien behavior or about aliens. You agree with that?
Yeah, for sure, you know, because that part of it is such a mystery that much of my thoughts in that area are speculative, whereas, you know, people's reaction to all this has really taught me a lot.
Okay. What? One last question here on this whole note. Is this the book, the publishing of this book, Fire in the Sky? Is this the is this, like, if you would, the final chapter in this? Are there anything in the future planned for?
Well, I think it is, you know, and I hope it is. I think I've said everything. I went into great detail, much more than some people would have preferred, but it's everything that I could possibly get together is in there.
Okay. Mike and Travis, I want to thank you very much for joining us on the program tonight. It's been very interesting, and again, I want to commend both of you on the courage that you have. You've put up with quite a lot of stuff over the years, and doggone it, that's just it's been quite an experience, I'm sure. And again, the book is called Fire in the Sky, The Walton Experience. It was written by Travis Walton. It's published by Marlowe and Company. It's available on the bookshelves in all your bookstores. And again, I highly recommend that you read this. Travis does have a section in here that he spends a considerable amount of time on refuting the claims that were leveled against him by our arch debunker out there, Phil Klass, and somebody who I personally never have been able to get on the right side of because I just don't agree with his methodology, if you will. He does not do any service to the skeptical side of things for the research community. And again, next week, be sure and join us. We have Kevin Randall, who's going to talk about his Roswell information, and we're going to get an update from Kevin, up-to-the-minute stuff on what's going on with Roswell. I mean, you might be surprised, too, what Kevin's take is on some of this material that has been handed over to the Roswell Museum and some of this other stuff that we're hearing about. And also on May the 12th, you would be sure to want to join us. We have Dr. Edgar Mitchell, who is going to be on the program. He's going to talk about his newest book, The Way of the Explorer, and he's also going to talk about his revelations on Dateline. So be sure and stay tuned for that. Until next week, I'm Michael Corbin telling you to keep your eyes on the skies. Good night.